Sometimes going to the grocery store can be chaotic. There doesn't seem to be enough time to check the list, make sure everything is there, search for the best prices, and take the time to make sure you get the best quality meat. So let ButcherBox help you out. Giving you peace of mind, ButcherBox delivers high-quality meat and seafood that you can trust straight to your door. No grocery carts required. Humanely raised, no antibiotics or hormones, 100% grass-fed, free-range, and crate-free. What more can you ask for? What about free shipping, customized box plans, exclusive member deals, recipe inspirations, tips, and tricks? You really can't go wrong with ButcherBox. Sign up at butcherbox.com/morningcup and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional $20 off. Choose salmon, chicken breasts, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/morningcup and use code morningcup to choose your free for a year offer plus get $20 off your first order. Today's podcast is brought to you by Newspapers.com, the ultimate destination for exploring the mysteries of the past. If you're fascinated by true crime, get ready to dive into the stories that made headlines. Newspapers.com offers a billion pages of historical newspapers from the U.S. and beyond, and you can search the entire collection in seconds. Their vast newspaper collection is a goldmine for eyewitness accounts, crime scene photos, news reports, and more. Whether you're interested in famous crimes or long-forgotten cases, Newspapers.com gives you a front-row seat to more than 300 years of history. For our listeners, Newspapers.com has a special offer. Use the code CUPOFMURDER for an exclusive 20% discount on your subscription. That's promo code CUPOFMURDER at Newspapers.com. Sign up today and start unraveling the true crime mysteries that keep you up at night.
There were two more murders 15 miles away.
When police arrived, they found the telephones and electricity lines.
We have a weird homicide.
A scene described by one investigator as reminiscent of a weird...
Morning.
Cup of murder.
Time and time again, we hear about picture-perfect homes holding horrors we could never imagine. Today's story began as one such case. But even when faced with the ample evidence to prove otherwise, many felt as though their hands were tied and left unable to help. On April 11th, 1965, a young boy lost his life at the hands of a perfect adoptive mother who saw him as nothing more than a bad seed. So if you like your coffee hot but your bones chilled, sit back and start your day with a morning cup of murder. Dennis Craig Puckett was born on December 6, 1961, to a pair of teenagers who, at the insistence of the authorities, put their son up for adoption in hopes that someone could give him the care that he needed. Adopted by the Jurgens of White Bear Lake, Minnesota, his father became Harold, a former bandleader turned electrician, and Lois, a homemaker. Now, prior to adopting Dennis, Lois had grown up in an impoverished home with 16 other siblings, and, according to the sources, used her marriage to Harold as a means to improve her social standings. A woman with a pathological need to have control over every aspect of her life, she was known to obsessively clean her home and tend to her garden. Though viewed as the perfect housewife, things were incredibly overwhelming for Lois, and in the years before Dennis entered their lives, she suffered from bouts of depression and even psychosis that led to institutionalization and electroconvulsive therapy. Later diagnosed with having mixed psychoneurosis, though she was unable to conceive a child with her husband, driving her further into a depressive state, the couple was officially forbidden to adopt due to her mental state, but somehow they managed to get their hands on a baby named Robert through a private adoption. Finally able to complete the picture-perfect family that she always wanted, Lois switched gears and became a mother who, from an early age, Robert learned to placate by staying out of her way and never to cause any undue mess. Though things might not have been as wonderful behind closed doors as they seemed from the outside, the adoption was considered a wild success in the eyes of authorities, who had a change of heart and allowed the Jurgens to adopt more children through official channels. Enter 1-year-old Dennis Craig Jurgens. Placed with Harold and Lois in 1962 in anticipation of an adoption after spending most of his first year in foster care, everyone hoped that Dennis would thrive under the care of an experienced and, by all accounts, loving foster mother. Instead, almost from the moment he entered the home, Lois felt a severe and obsessive dislike for the boy, who, unlike the son she already raised, was the typical energetic, rambunctious, and spirited toddler who had not learned to fear the woman who was raising him. In her eyes, Robert was her, quote, good son, and Dennis was simply a nuisance. Described as an intense and angry woman with a short fuse and a volatile temper, things were so strained inside the home that Harold at some point suggested that they should not go forward with the adoption, but Lois, worried that it would discourage the authorities from allowing her to adopt future children, refused despite her increasing anger. Within just months of his arrival, Dennis Jurgens was rushed to the hospital with both first and second degree burns on his genitalia. The harrowing ordeal was dubbed an accident, and not long after, the adoption process was officially complete. From the time he entered the home at 1 year old until he was about 3 and a half, Dennis suffered at the abusive hands of his sadistic adoptive mother, a woman whose husband never made much effort in stopping, even though he himself never laid hands on the boy. Believing that corporal punishment was the only way to make the boy, quote, right, Lois spent years torturing the young toddler in her care. Like when she, angered by the boy rejecting the food that she gave him, responded by placing horseradish on the food and force-feeding him until he was purple in the face from lack of oxygen. When he would vomit up what he was forced to eat, she would make him eat his own vomit. She also seemed to obsess over the young boy's weight, which, according to his medical records, was completely appropriate for his age at the time, but would frequently starve him in an effort to rid him of his, quote, sloppy fat, a term that she later used as his nickname. Because of this, Dennis gained only 3 pounds in the 2.5 years he lived with the Jurgens, and, according to the coroner who later studied his small body, he had almost zero subcutaneous fat and was at the same level as someone who died of starvation. In addition to the incident with the burns, Dennis became the victim of other abuses that would fall under the category of sexual sadism. Like when he wet his diaper, again, a completely normal action of a child his age, and Lois responded by clipping a spring-action clothespin to the tip of his penis to stop him from urinating. And that same coroner who noted his terrifying weight also found evidence of adult human bite marks on the boy's penis and scarring all over his scrotum. Later testifying in courts, neighbors and family members claimed that Dennis would often show up to public events wearing sunglasses to hide his frequent black eyes. And on some occasions, Lois would allegedly tie the boy's limbs to the bedposts to keep him from getting up during the night, and secured him to the toilet to try and force a bowel movement. Never once apologizing for her actions, Lois believed that all of this, and more, was the appropriate way to discipline her, quote, bad child. Believing as a devout Catholic that she was doing, quote, God's work by making her son, quote, perfect in her eyes. In fact, both her sons were forced into religious training, and while reports claim that Robert could flawlessly recite the rosary at just 2 years old, when Dennis struggled with the work, he was forced to pray and do his recitations while kneeling on a broomstick for extended periods of time. Though those close to the family saw signs that something was amiss inside the Jurgens' home, but did nothing to stop it out of fear of Lois's retribution, to the casual observer, Harold and Lois seemed like the perfect church-going family who kept a beautiful home and selflessly adopted children in need. And because the term child abuse had yet to be coined, and no one, not even medical professionals, were required to report their concerns, Dennis was left in the care of his sadistic adoptive mother and stayed there until April 11th, 1965. According to the sources, on that night, a great flood hit the St. Paul area, and as the Mississippi River's waters rose to record highs, flooding began inside the homes of many families, including the Jurgens. Completely enraged over the floodwaters filling her basement, something occurred early that morning that caused the perforation of young Dennis's small bowel, causing peritonitis and, ultimately, his death. Though the exact chain of events remained unknown for many years, with the sole witness being 5-year-old Robert, it was clear from the state of his body that the young boy had been brutally beaten and starved for most of his young life at the hands of a woman who was supposed to care for him. It wouldn't be until he was 27 years old, though, that Robert would finally recount the events from that evening, testifying that his mother beat young Dennis extensively and then threw his fragile body down a flight of stairs. Though there were investigations into the incident, as stated before, the idea of abuse taking place in a middle-class home seemed hard to believe and even more difficult to actually prove. So, in spite of all the physical evidence pointing towards severe abuse, the medical examiner marked the death as, quote, deferred. Later, a great deal of suspicion was thrown at a man named Jerome Zerwas, a police lieutenant for the city of White Bear Lake, and Lois Jurgens' brother, who many believe might have interfered with the investigation and destroyed any incriminating evidence against his sister. Though there wasn't enough evidence to charge her with Dennis's murder, there was enough suspicion that Robert was removed from the home and placed with various relatives and a foster family for the next handful of years, while his parents fought like hell to regain custody. Eventually placed with his paternal grandparents at Harold and Lois's request, that arrangement ended due to a house fire that saw the death of his grandmother. There was a lot of suspicion floating around that Lois herself caused the fire, especially considering the exact date coincided with a time where Robert, in the hospital with pneumonia, was safely out of the house. He was eventually sent to live with more relatives before finally returning to Lois and Harold in 1969 at the age of 10. His return came after the couple hired a new lawyer who just so happened to be good friends with the judge who presided over the juvenile court custody hearing, and against the wishes of a Ramsey County social worker who told police that she strongly opposed Robert's return due to her belief that Dennis had been murdered. She later said that she was discouraged by her supervisors and the prosecutor from looking into the past and was told by the then assistant county attorney, Paul Lindholm, that Dennis's file was missing. Determining that Lois was fine to raise her son again, leaving many who believed her to be dangerous completely helpless, Robert was returned home, and the couple, despite their history, was able to adopt 4 school-age siblings from Kentucky in 1972. Despite social workers expressing their concern, quieted by their supervisors, the Houghton children, 3 brothers and a sister, were sent to Minnesota because the state of Kentucky wanted them off welfare, and the Jurgenses, of course being paid a salary to take the kids in, had a letter from their pastor, Father Bernard Reiser, supporting the decision and explaining what good candidates they were to care for the siblings. With favorable psychological evaluations as well, it was almost as if Dennis and what happened to him didn't even exist. What they didn't know or what they didn't take the time to learn was that Lois's mental state was rapidly deteriorating, and unable to keep up appearances any longer, she and Harold relocated to Stillwater, Minnesota, to escape all the gossip in their former town. It was here that the siblings, eventually in 1975, ran away from home with the help of concerned neighbors. Going to the police, the kids told officers how Lois would wake them up in the middle of the night to inspect their rooms, beating them if she found a speck of dust or hangers crossed in the closet. Made them stand barefoot in the snow. How she once grabbed one of the boys by his ears and slammed his forehead onto a protruding nail in the wall. And how she would order Harold to beat the children. And he, still unwilling to join in on his wife's behavior, would take them down to the basement, tell them to scream, and smack his own leg to try and placate her. They were so filled with fear that the sound of her door squeaking or the sight of her car in the driveway from the school bus would send them into a complete panic. Their tales of abuse, coupled with the still present suspicion surrounding Dennis's death, was enough to finally terminate Lois and Harold's parental rights, and they were soon informed that they were now no longer allowed to foster or adopt any more children. While the siblings were assessed and spent years in therapy trying to deal with their pain, now in her late 30s, Jerry Sherwood, Dennis's birth mother, began a personal mission to find the baby that she placed up for adoption as a teenager. Having given birth to four more children with Dennis's birth father, she hoped to introduce her children to their brother, only to find that all of her searches led her to his burial site. Wanting to know what happened, she managed to get a hold of Lois Jurgens, who cordially offered to mail some of her son's mementos to his birth mother. When those items never arrived, Jerry called again, only to find that in the short period of time between phone calls, the Jurgens had switched to an unlisted number. By now, she was suspicious enough to dig into her son's death certificate and found that it was categorized as deferred and that the case was technically still an open one. Jerry took what little she knew to the White Bear Lake Police Department on September 11, 1986, claiming her belief that her baby had been beaten to death in the care of his adoptive mother, pushed further, and took her story to the media. While officers at the station, some who were the original investigators from all those years before, started to look into their options, the St. Paul Pioneer Press ran a cover story on the case. And though they did not name the Jurgenses, those who lived in the city and familiar with the couple knew exactly who the report was talking about. Jerry fought to keep her son's case in the public eye, and eventually, Lois Jurgens was arraigned and charged with the murder of three-year-old Dennis. Later described as one of the few crimes that could legitimately be described as ritual abuse, the courts heard devastating details of Dennis's many injuries and the emaciated state of his body when brought in after his death. Wounds and marks that were so deep that when the body was exhumed in 1987, they were still present. With Robert testifying against his mother, now in her 60s, Lois Jurgens was convicted of third-degree murder, but served just 8 years before being released on good behavior. She lived a secluded life until her death on May 7th, 2013. She proclaimed her innocence until her dying day. However, when her husband died in 2000, there was suspicion that she poisoned him and that he became her final victim. This was later investigated, however, and eventually ruled out. Thank you for joining me in my morning cup of murder. Please join me again tomorrow to hear a terrible thing happened on April 12th. Don't forget to rate and subscribe and let me know how you like it. If you want to help support the podcast, there's always Patreon or just sharing it with your true crime obsessed friends. And remember, stay safe.